Hi, and welcome to Measure the Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
Yeah, we're going to tell you what it is, we're going to tell you why it is, we're going to tell you where it is, we're going to tell you who it is, who did it, we're going to go deep. We're going to go right into the details of what this thing is and why you should care about it.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So today we're talking about the Great Zimbabwe. Do you know anything about that, John?
No, I know literally nothing about that. Oh, wait, no, that's not true. So I know that Zimbabwe is a country?
That's right. That is correct.
I know that it's in Africa. I wasn't sure if it was a country or a state or just what, but Zimbabwe, Africa.
It is, yes. Zimbabwe is a country that's in southern Africa, just north of South Africa.
Okay.
So it's just above it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's mostly inland.
Yeah.
That matters.
It's important to know, mostly inland.
So the Great Zimbabwe is an Iron Age city that is now mostly in ruins, but at the height of its power, it housed approximately 10,000 to 20,000 Shona people, which is a group of Bantu-speaking people in southern Africa. It's a pretty large population in Zimbabwe today. There's 11 million of them in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
So it's a city that no longer really exists.
Gotcha.
So it's built during medieval times, so medieval Africa, which coincides actually with medieval Europe. And
interesting.
Right. So we're talking about 11th to 15th century.
Okay.
And what's interesting is I'm going to describe what this city looks like and or what this city looks like based on what we can tell from the ruins and the archaeological discoveries, but it's going to bear a lot of similarities to medieval Europe.
Right.
The ruins extend over 80 hectares.
Okay.
So that's 800,000 square kilometers.
Right. 800,000 square kilometers.
That's right.
How big is like a normal city? I'm getting hung up on like square kilometers, right?
Yes.
But you think of like the width of a city being, you know, some cities are like 40 kilometers or whatever to drive from the north to the south.
So Toronto is 630 square kilometers.
Wow.
And this is 800,000.
Yes.
So those are the overall ruins. And this is basically where you can find settlement. It's not really the densest part of the city, but mm-hmm. I suppose it'd be like the GTA of Great Zimbabwe.
Yeah, your metropolitan area.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Which, of course, would extend farther back then because it was also including like the agricultural
yep.
area.
Mm-hmm. It's big is what we're trying
exactly.
to say. Yeah.
All things considered, it was a pretty huge settlement. Just like a regular city, there were localized spots for specific functions of the city. For example, for ceremonial or religious purposes,
mm-hmm.
for trade and commerce, for general living of the overall population. Yeah, so very interesting place.
Yeah.
It's been designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site since 1986.
Okay.
And one of the big reasons why I wanted to talk about the Great Zimbabwe is it's a really, really awesome representation of kind of like the height of African architecture and engineering.
Right.
So from the continent.
Which is not really something that we've discussed on the podcast yet.
No, exactly. I think outside of kind of Northern Africa,
yeah.
you have a lot more to talk about that's more commonly known.
Yeah.
But south of like the Saharan Desert, basically, it's not well preserved. And that's mainly the problem is that, and I'm going to go into a lot of why it's not well-preserved and why we have so little information about Great Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
But a lot of it does have to do with a colonial history.
Oh.
So that's a big reason for why I wanted to talk about the Great Zimbabwe today. It's a amazing sight, really, if you think about a lot of the ancient cities that people would love to visit, things like Machu Picchu, places, you know, that showcase, like even Petra, they showcase an ancient civilization or monuments, and really you can see a way of life from their architecture.
Yep.
And this is a really great example. It also, I find it, like I said, really interesting that it existed in the same time as medieval Europe. And the site overall is built up of stone, granite-built walls,
okay,
and buildings.
Yeah.
And if I picture medieval Europe, like that's what it looks like to me, right? Like stoned.
Yeah, yeah.
Stone structures, stone walls.
Yeah.
And this was very much like that.
Okay. Which is it's interesting because this is Iron Age.
Yes.
But we're talking about stone. Stone Age is way different.
I mean, we never built buildings out of iron, right?
No, I know.
The idea that it was an Iron Age. So Iron Age meant they were starting to use iron and smelt iron for the purposes of
tools.
Making weapons and tools. Exactly.
I get it. But I'm just trying to get across the point. You know, somebody tells you Iron Age, think stone. Someone tells you Stone Age, think wood. That's my point. That's my point.
So it was a great center of trade, like I said, from the 11th to the 15th century.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the trade revolved around crops, animals, and gold. But there are also, of course, minerals because they were in the Iron Age. So the Great Zimbabwe site itself is surrounded by more than 4,000 gold mines,
mm-hmm,
and 500 copper mines.
Ooh.
So it was really quite a wealthy area.
Yeah, which is going to prove tragic later in the story, I assume?
Not in the way that you think, yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
So over these 3 centuries, it's estimated that 40% of the world's total mined gold came from this area.
Okay.
Which is pretty significant.
Yeah.
And the trade extended from the Great Zimbabwe all the way to other parts of continental Africa, to Asia and the Middle East. And they know this because they found evidence of cowrie shells and glassware from Syria, minted coins from Kilwa, which is an island off of Tanzania, Persian and Chinese ceramics.
Ooh.
And Chinese ceramics is a pretty good indication of how far trade has gone because it's very unique as a,
right,
as an item, right? It's easy to identify.
Yeah.
Traded in gold, of course, in copper goods, not just the raw material, but artisanal, manufactured or shaped,
yeah,
objects, whether it's jewelry or statues,
hmm,
or tools.
Cool.
Although I don't think you make tools out of gold.
You would, making tools out of gold or copper is not the best way to make a tool, I'll tell you that.
And of course, they traded in ivory as well.
Oh, okay. Poor elephants.
Yes. I don't know how ethical it was back then, but, you know, it was a practice.
Yeah, it was just a thing. I'm not gonna trash ancient civilizations for having different ethics.
Yeah. Don't trade in ivory now.
Yes.
Now it would be bad. Back then, I don't even know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it. We've reached a point as a species where we need to be more considerate of our impact on the planet.
Right, exactly.
Right? Back then, you needed to be more considerate of what you needed at that time.
So it's pretty unclear why Great Zimbabwe kind of fell into ruins, why the trade declined. But people did end up abandoning the sites. And there's so much of the written records of this by colonialists, of course. Europeans call this the lost city, that it was rediscovered, when in reality, the Shona people, so the local population, had known about it, of course.
Like, yeah,
they knew it existed. They just didn't live there anymore.
Yeah.
It wasn't useful for them.
Yeah.
So they left.
We get that in Canada. We get that all the time. The first man to see the Arctic or like Mount Everest, right? The first man to scale Mount Everest. And it's just like, he was shown there. right? I do appreciate in the last...
It's the first white guy.
Yeah, in the last handful of years, too, now that I've seen them credited as the first European settler to see this. But yeah, like certainly when I was growing up and even well into the 21st century, it was like the first person to do this, shown by his guides who had been there dozens of times before. It's just like, oh my God. Yeah, so...
That's it.
Yes. It's called Eurocentrism, and it's an ongoing problem in our culture.
Yeah. Right. So people did eventually abandon the site. There were some theories as to why. There's the idea that maybe the population, kind of the growth of the area and how much it was supporting in terms of agriculture, kind of destroyed the land. There was a lot of clearing of the properties to support the agriculture. So, of course, that always destroys the soil. It destroys a lot of the land, and it can make it really difficult and poor to grow anything, which is what you need to sustain a population like that.
Mm-hmm.
The overwhelming population on the natural resource is the general idea or theory of why the trade declined.
Yeah.
It could have also been that the area was fine to support a certain amount of agriculture, but it just takes a few bad years. Weather's unpredictable, so a drought can easily wipe things out.
Yeah.
So talking about the Great Zimbabwe, we should talk specifically about location first.
Okay.
So it's kind of on the southern side of Zimbabwe. So Zimbabwe doesn't really have a distinct shape. It's kind of just like a round blob.
Okay, a round blob. So we'll call it, let's call it, it's shaped like a human liver.
It's rounder than that.
Is it rounder than that? Shaped like a human gallbladder.
It kind of shaped like your head when your hair is not brushed.
Okay. So shaped like a messy head.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And it's kind of in the, like, under the nose area.
Gotcha.
So, like, not quite at the south-south tip, but kind of, like, south of middle.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Man,
I need to look at a map.
This is the weirdest way I've ever described thing on a country.
I should have looked at a map to have a general idea of the shape. I wasn't expecting to be quizzed on that.
It is located on a plateau.
Okay.
It has river and kind of watershed basins all around. There are mature old rivers to the north, younger, steeper rivers to the south. And all of this contributed to a lot of groundwater with natural springs, some of which are active all year round.
Yeah.
It's also really interesting because their primary source of rain is not actually rain, but more of a fog and a mist.
Interesting.
So in general, this area gets a lot more rainfall than the rest of Zimbabwe. So that's important supporting agriculture.
Yeah.
It's also going to be really important because there's a lot of smelting and metallurgy work involved in this area because of the mines, and metalwork requires a lot of water.
Okay. I never had considered that, but yeah, that makes sense.
Right. So my touch point for this is in Lord of the Rings, when the dwarves... Oh, no, in The Hobbit, when the dwarves are going through the mines and then, you know, like they go through that whole fight and there's the metal flowing, but there's also the water delivery system because you need to heat up the metal with the furnace and then you got to cool it really quickly by dropping water on it.
Yeah.
So that's why you need so much water.
Right. So if you know the difference between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, hit us up on social media.
Hey, now.
The Hobbit is... Bilbo.
Yes.
And then, yeah, okay.
Right. So the location of it was really quite ideal.
Yep.
It also, the Great Zimbabwe being kind of a stone enclosed city, or really multiple stone enclosures, there were multiple sites. It had its own drainage system as well, because like I said, it gets kind of quite a bit of water.
Yeah.
But you don't want that to be enclosed within your stone city because then it's just going to be marshy and gross, kind of like medieval Europe.
Yeah, turns into kind of like a dirty foot bath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like like London, like how we all imagine Paris in the 13th century.
Sure. Ugh, yuck. But they had a drainage system.
They did.
To make this better than Paris.
Exactly.
Excellent.
So their drainage system is basically centuries old, and it still works today.
Ooh, pretty good.
It collects water from houses and enclosures and drains them down into the valleys. And even the granite walls that surround the city have channels underneath to allow drainage outside of the enclosure. They also had a pretty sophisticated irrigation system for agriculture, so they were able to channel water specifically to where they wanted it.
Cool. It's a shame we don't know the name of their drainage engineer.
And then next, the layout, right? The layout is quite thoughtful, and it reflects a certain level of architectural planning.
Cool.
There are three main architectural zones. So the hill complex is the first one. It's the oldest, and it's the spiritual and religious center of the city. They suspect that it was built kind of around the 9th century, and it was used and inhabited until the 13th century.
Okay.
And all the enclosures and all the areas are pretty round. I don't know if that's a significant thing for them, but they generally built in a round site.
But that was pretty common, like building in circular.
Sure. I mean, everyone is kind of equidistant to the center.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a huge boulder within the hills complex that's shaped like the Zimbabwe bird, which is a recurring icon that is found throughout the Great Zimbabwe. It's suggested that this is the symbol of the king, and he would preside over rituals and pass judgment from this seat of the Great Zimbabwe bird.
Mm.
And in front of his seat would be kind of a raised platform where sacrifices would be made.
Right.
And I think something like depending on which way the smoke blew when you gave the sacrifice would be how much the gods liked it or something, which I feel like is like a pretty smart way to do it. Because if I was a shaman, controlling which way the smoke went just meant like making sure you pick a day where the wind is in your favor, right?
Yeah.
Like all you got to do is like lick your finger and hold it up and be like, I don't think the gods are hungry today, you know?
Right. Okay, I'll give you that. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a certain level of mysticism, but not essentially not much different than medieval Europe.
No, certainly not.
Yeah. So again, you know, Zimbabwe is very in line with Europe.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
The second architectural zone is the Great Enclosure. This is basically the heart and the most iconic part of Great Zimbabwe. It really operated only for kind of two centuries, from the 13th to the 15th century.
Okay.
It included a huge circular wall made of cut granite blocks. The outer wall is 5 meters thick.
Mm.
Just in terms of thickness, it's 5 meters thick. And it's about 9 to 11 meters high, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
And it is 250 meters in circumference.
Okay.
So kind of the length of the thing around.
Yeah.
And it's estimated that the wall is made out of roughly 900,000 pieces of professionally sliced granite blocks. And they're laid on top of each other with no mortar. There is nothing holding these blocks together other than just sheer gravity and precision.
Hmm. Pretty cool.
There's also an inner wall. And so between them, you get this narrow passageway, which is how you get inside.
Right.
And it leads inwards to a conical tower. So in the center of this great enclosure is kind of a cone, also made out of granite blocks, also with no mortar. The outer wall is decorated with soapstone sculptures of the Zimbabwe bird, again.
Okay.
Which is something roughly like a bird with human lips and five-fingered feet.
Okay. It sounds like a bird that you could kiss and hold hands with. So.
It's so iconic that it is today on the national flag of Zimbabwe.
Okay, cool. That's good. So they do like that bird.
The bird you can kiss and hold hands with.
I'm just saying, I think birds are like, I like ducks. right? I like ducks, but other than that, birds are just like, ugh, give me a break. So if you got a bird that you can, you know, give some smooches, then it's like, all right, here we go.
So weird. So weird. Okay. And the last of the architectural zones is the Valley Complex. And this also was inhabited between the 13th and the 15th century. This last area is made up of little living spaces.
Okay.
Mostly kind of earth and mud brick houses. So this is where most of the people live. This is kind of, I guess, the suburb or the homes. Mm-hmm. It was also a hub for commercial exchange and where long-distance trade may happen. There were roughly 2,000 goldsmiths that lived in the area, and some amount kind of equal to that of potters, weavers, blacksmiths, and of course, stonemasons.
Yes.
And there's evidence found of iron smelting and gold smelting furnaces, archaeological remains like crucibles, ingots, casts, hammers, chisels, and things to make wires with. So quite advanced.
Hmm.
This is also where the granite bricks would be made.
Right.
To build the Great Zimbabwe. And the way they did this was they would heat the large granite rocks in a fire and then douse it with water, which would cause the granite to suddenly crack along its fracture planes.
Right.
And turn into kind of brick-shaped pieces.
Hmm. Clever.
So I'll talk a little bit more about these walls, because this is really the quite interesting part of the Great Zimbabwe. These things are huge, and it's kind of like building a tall wall with no glue, no cement, mm-hmm. no nothing. It's not like Lego. They didn't fit into each other.
Yeah, they just sat.
They just sat real well.
Yeah. Work smarter, not harder, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And for this reason, they actually do not think that it served any defensive purposes.
Right. So it was just like a...
They believe it might be a show of power
okay.
of the king
yep.
to be able to build something so big. So it was really, if you kind of think of like things like the Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
Right. It's a show of opulence more than it is a show of defense or fortification.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, despite saying that it did have turrets and towers, it had sculpted stairways, decorative things, kind of like fortresses that you would think of in Europe. In the same time. They were usually circular, like I said, and recessed just slightly as the walls went up to create a stability so that it wouldn't fall. And so it would just kind of taper in.
Okay.
It dovetailed. So they figured out how to also arrange the rock so that it would dovetail around natural features. So they didn't have to move things. If they encountered a giant boulder in the area, they would kind of build it into the wall.
Hmm. Clever.
Everything snaked around. There was kind of a real curvature. And there are actually like modern sculptors and artists who have built huge art installations that are very similar, right? So that when you walk in, there is this weird harmonious sense of space, I suppose.
Gotcha.
Because it's a circular area.
Yeah.
But it was finished so precisely. And you'll see in the pictures that we post that these walls, like, they're not jagged. Because I think, like, I've certainly visited some fortresses in Europe where it's built out of stones, kind of around the same age. And it's rough and jagged, right?
Yeah.
There are things that are poking in and out. These are granite blocks. Like, if you think of your granite countertops.
Oh, yeah.
Right? These are smooth. And the way that they're laid on top of each other, it's much prettier.
Interesting.
I suppose.
Yeah.
It's not as jagged. It's definitely faced well.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real art and care that's been put into building these.
Hmm.
They've also worked patterns into the walls. So there's herringbone patterns that you can find in the walls, chevrons, and they built in vertical grooves. There are also doorways, of course, so that you can enter in. And it would be supported above by a wooden frame.
Yeah.
Right? Just kind of some wooden scaffolding, some beams and joists. But still, on top of that are granite blocks.
Wow.
And it's continuous.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the soapstone bird sculptures also really reflect of workmanship.
Right.
Really quite interesting. The metallurgy is very advanced. What they were constructing or what they were building out of the mines that were nearby. It really shows a very innovative and sophisticated civilization.
Right.
Really good understanding of materials, how to work with them, and trade, of course. Mm-hmm. So there's really an exchange of not just goods, but also ideas with surrounding civilizations. And not even surrounding civilizations. Like, China is really freaking far from Africa, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that is like, I don't know if you if you look at a map, there's a long ways to go.
China is probably further from Zimbabwe than like Toronto is from Vancouver.
Maybe. I don't even know. We'd have to look that up.
Yeah, but it's real far.
Yeah, that's the point. So it is. Yeah, it shows, you know, considerable.
Yeah, exchange, right? So that being said, it's understood that the Great Zimbabwe kind of were in touch with the Middle East and China. Yeah. And even though it wasn't discovered by Europe for a while, like several centuries, it was known and it was bustling.
Cool.
The details that we have on the Great Zimbabwe now are not terrific. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of plundering that occurred in the 19th and 20th century by European explorers and treasure hunters. And a lot of it was justified by this like Indiana Jones attitude of we need to preserve the artifacts and therefore bring it back to European museums.
Yeah.
It also, I'm going to go through a pretty sad history here. But I'm going to list all the people that worked so, so very hard to try to convince the world that the Great Zimbabwe was built by white people.
Oh, God. All right, here we go.
So white colonialists were really in denial for over a century about Africans building something so monumental, really. Mm-hmm. In the mid-19th century, Karl Mauch claimed that he found cedar from Lebanon in the site and therefore made up this myth that the ruins were built by the Queen of Sheba, which is some story out of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Real weird. In 1890, the British mining magnate and the colonizer Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah, I know that name, actually.
Cecil Rhodes was a colonialist, and actually the colonial name for Zimbabwe was Rhodesia, which is named after Cecil Rhodes.
Rhodes, that explains it.
Cecil Rhodes financed archaeologist James Theodore Bent, and he was also sent by the British Association of Science to, quote-unquote, prove that the Great Zimbabwe civilization was not built by local Africans. Digging real hard here.
Yeah.
In 1902, Richard Nicklin Hall, who was a British journalist, was appointed the curator of the Great Zimbabwe by the British South Africa Company for the purpose, quote unquote, not of scientific research, but the preservation of the building.
Uh-huh.
And by doing so under this mandate, he destroyed a significant part of the site, claiming that he was trying to remove the filth and decadence of the African occupation.
All right. African occupation as well.
He was trying to basically destroy evidence that it was built by Africans. And he tried to search for signs, any clue, any inkling that the city was built by white people.
Yeah.
And he destroyed up to 4 meters of archaeological deposits. So 4 meters deep of soil and archaeological remains was destroyed as he tried to find anything, just digging up whatever he could.
Yeah.
So fast forward a little bit more. 1979.
Okay.
The Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia at the time is what it's called, Ian Smith. He created false official guidebooks. So these were official guidebooks with false information in them, basically.
Okay.
He created them showing images of Africans bowing down to foreigners who supposedly built the Great Zimbabwe.
Oh, lovely.
You know how I've always loved, like, I have this weird little obsession with collecting racist maps because I just...
Yeah, yeah.
Like to... It's just evidence, right? Just
yeah.
Like, this is the most blatant colonial BS.
Yeah, I can vouch for this. I have gone with Vivian to many an antique shop, and she always gravitates towards, like, oh, these old maps. Oh my God, look at this thing right here.
It'll be just something so ridiculous. It'll be like, yeah, colonial maps with terrible borders, old colonial names, and some awful illustration of, yeah, Africans bowing down to foreigners.
Yeah, but when you think of the amount of, like, material wealth that was stolen from Africa,
yeah,
they had to do absolutely everything that they could to support this narrative that, you know, that the white man brought civilization, right? Everything. And it's just this fear. This is the thing that I cannot understand about white supremacy, is just, like, the fear that you might not be the best, right? And it's just like, ugh, I can't figure it out.
Well, that's it. They just could not fathom that there was another civilization. Like, it's just so absurd. So that's kind of the basic history. And so this was up till 1979.
Okay.
And by the way, 1980... 40 years ago was when Zimbabwe gained independence from Britain.
Yeah.
40 years ago.
Yeah.
And that is when it got its name Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And Zimbabwe is supposedly the Shona word for stone houses.
Okay.
And so that's why the Great Zimbabwe is called that.
Yeah.
And the country's name is derived from the Great Zimbabwe. This is such a monumental site that they were so proud of as African nationalists that they adopted it as its country's name.
Cool.
Right. So in 1980, Robert Mugabe became the prime minister and the country was renamed Zimbabwe in honor of the Great Zimbabwe. And the famous soapstone bird carvings became part of the new Zimbabwean flag.
Yes.
But still, in that era, in the 1980s, a lot more destruction happened through reconstruction attempts by nationalists. And it still continues to be pretty problematic because it gets 20,000 tourists a year.
Right. Yeah.
And there's not a lot of control. You know, people kind of climb over things. People take pieces. It's not great. Today, the general consensus is that the Great Zimbabwe was built by the ancestors of the Shona people.
Good. That's good to hear.
With probably contributions of groups that were also living in Zimbabwe at the time.
Yeah.
And like I said, in 1986, it became a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Cool.
And now it faces also the threat of overgrown vegetation.
Yep.
And some of the invasive species that are kind of undermining the stability of the stone walls. Because keep in mind, there's no mortar holding it together.
Yeah.
If the ground shakes, this thing will fall apart.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. And also, I mean, you think of, you know, like a tree root forcing its way through a sidewalk.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nature is powerful, man.
Stops for nothing.
Like I said, the general history of the Great Zimbabwe is largely unknown. It's really hard to prove anything. And a lot of it is still not really excavated properly.
Right.
A lot of it is destroyed. A lot of it isn't uncovered yet.
Yeah, a lot of it's been plundered.
That's right. Yeah. And a lot of it can also be learned through the oral history of the Shona people.
Okay.
But in general, I know that maybe this episode wasn't as engineering heavy, but I think it's really important to highlight that this exists.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to highlight, you know, that Africans built something really comparable and capable.
Yeah.
Compared to contemporaries of the time.
Yeah.
And if I were to not have done this episode because we didn't have enough information on it as a result of colonial destruction, then they'll have won.
Yeah, that's actually a very fair point. Like you think of the fact that we stumbled our way through Stonehenge, right? And it's just like, I think that Stonehenge is very cool. But the only noteworthy thing about it is that these are big rocks, right? Whereas we're talking about a proper stone city that was developed independently, but in parallel with similar, arguably inferior developments going on in Europe, which has since tried to support this narrative that Europeans brought civilization to Africa.
Exactly.
And it's just insane. So, yeah, I think that it is very important to start even working to deconstruct this idea that still holds very true today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm not African and I don't have African roots, so it's not for me to reclaim this narrative, but I hope that I've contributed a little bit to destroying the falsehood, you know, that surrounds monuments by Africans. I think that's really important. And I really hope that, yeah, we can just reframe the conversation around this. I think this is a really interesting site. There are lots of great pictures about this. And even just the architectural sense of space, I think I've already said this, but the sense of space that they were able to construct out of stones, just piles of stones, right, is really significant. I'm just trying to find, there was an artist that really did something very similar in terms of art installation, where he had concentric circles, like huge, tall circles that you can walk in and with a narrow passage. And it's supposed to give you this like confined time of like meditation as you walk through the narrow passage. And it feels constricting as you go through, but then as you come to the center, it suddenly makes you feel like you've got space and like a freedom, even though you're now actually within two walls of circles. It's tricking you. And it's so, like when I read and saw the descriptions of the Great Zimbabwe, the Great Enclosure, it was so much like this. And for art to be repeated, you know, to be repeating this basically is really just, I don't know, it's proof that there's merit in it, right? Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing that is probably worth addressing, and I believe that we spoke of this, we've made reference to it, you know, in past episodes, but is this idea that, you know, colonialism, the impacts are still so overwhelmingly central to today's world.
Yes.
Right? This is not something that happened in the past. This is something that established a pattern of domination that continues to this day. Right. And I still remember like the Panama Canal episode that we did. And it was just like, oh, wow, you know, a bunch of European settlers going in and taking advantage of local labor and laying claim to this major. And it was like, In my mind, I knew, oh yeah, this was problematic, but it didn't, I don't know. I do think that it's important for us to, moving forward, be more responsible to actually highlight, you know, the damage that continues to come down today.
Well, and I think a big part of that conversation as well is the monuments and the artifacts need to go home.
Yeah.
Right? I am always a little bit wary when I go to a museum in the West and they have artifacts that were not borrowed, right? Because museums lend their artifacts around the world all the time. And that's fine. That's an exchange. That's world tour. Do what you want. But when it's a permanent installation outside of the country that it came from, like I'm Chinese, there are so many artifacts that were lost during the Opium War. And that just makes me so sad.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the artifacts from the Great Zimbabwe were taken away, quote unquote, for safekeeping.
Yeah, because now, even if you do have an interest in the history of the Great Zimbabwe, you are not necessarily going to Zimbabwe to see and experience that. You can go to a museum in London, you can go to museums all around the world and support those economies to learn about something that really does not belong to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Long-winded way of saying, I think this is a really important episode for the long term and also for the current Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm going to work a lot harder to try to find representation of monuments that have been forgotten.
Yeah. Or I mean, monuments that have been, you know, forcefully retold.
That's right. And I really hope that you guys are on board with this. I really actually learned a lot researching this episode. It's not something that I knew anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not be super recognizable when compared with things like the Panama Canal. But I learned a lot and it's super interesting. And it's definitely a destination I would like to visit one day.
I think that would be pretty cool.
And that wraps up our episode today. If you enjoyed this or if you have any comments, feedback, hit us up on our social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Measure to Metric. There's also our website, measuretometric.com.
Yeah.
You can also leave a rating or a comment on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on right now. And we look forward to another great episode 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now. Yep. Oh, we're coming in actually a little bit short this week. So congratulations. You got a few minutes of your day back.
As always, thank you to Astronomic Audio for sound editing and producing this
sound
episode.
Sound design, mastering services, I mean, guidance.
That's
on
true.
All
yeah.
sorts of stuff. Like, it's just really lovely with everybody being home. You know, there's a lot of things that you might know about and you think, you know, I really know a lot about this topic, or I would really like to discuss this topic further. Maybe I should start a podcast. Contact Astronomic Audio because they're going to tell you everything that you need to know.
Yeah, technologically or even just in a marketing space. They've been terrific.
Yeah.
And of course, John created all the music for this episode. And if you like that, I'm sure he would also really enjoy hearing back from you.
Aw, shucks.
And in the meantime, we'll be back in 2 weeks. And I hope you stay measured and metric.
Stay metric, folks.
Stay metric. I don't know.
I like it. All right. Good night.